Welcome to the Painting Lines Podcast, your one-stop shop for all things tennis. Join Eric and Aiden in their discussion for updates on news and pop culture, and from hot takes to betting, they've got you covered.
Ready? Set. Welcome back to Painting Lines. Last week we had Parth and Quinn on, two former collegiate tennis players who gave us great insight on what it would be like to play college tennis. This week we'll be recapping the Paris Masters tournament. And what are your initial thoughts on the tournament? I mean, I'm sure we're not surprised by the outcome, but what did you think overall?
Well, we talked with Quinn and Parth last week, like you said, and a funny comment that they made when we were talking about their projection for the tournament. We were like, who do you think is going to do well in this tournament? And Quinn was like, well, Djokovic is playing in it. And so it was kind of almost a foregone conclusion. And that kind of ended up being true. I mean, even though Dimitrov was in like top form in that final, it wasn't ever in question, it seemed like, that Djokovic was going to win that.
Yeah, kind of on the same page. Not really shocked by Djokovic winning, but I am pretty surprised that Runa and Tsitsipas made pretty deep runs. It's good to see them. But then also Alcaraz, surprised there.
100%.
Because be honest, you could have thought he would have won the tournament going in, no?
Yeah, I think he definitely like had a chance, obviously, but based on the way he was talking before, it seemed like the injury was definitely a factor. It was kind of surprising that he was going to play in this tournament. It seemed like he might pull out of it. And he plays and then loses in his first round. So it's not the biggest shock in the world, but it's still a shock because if he's playing, you expect him to play close to his top form.
Right. And I feel like that's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. If you go into a tournament telling everyone, oh yeah, don't expect too much from me, I'm injured, I don't know how well this is going to go, I feel like you're doing that. So when you do lose, you're like, see, I told you guys. So, all right, let's get into this first round. What'd you see here?
Some upsets in that first round, like Shelton losing to Davidovich Fokina. Another first round loss for Shelton, but I really don't think that his recent form was a fluke because obviously Davidovich Fokina is a guy that's in the top 30. So he's a very solid player, a guy that made the semifinals in Canada earlier this year. And it was a very close match. It wasn't like Davidovich Fokina blew him out. Shelton battled. And even though he lost in the first round, I think it's just sometimes you lose matches.
Mm-hmm, that's fair. I think Fokina handled his serve very well too, because Shelton's expected to win that match. I mean, based off rankings.
I think that the situation is that Shelton has been playing very well recently. And I think his peak playing level is higher than Fokina has shown. But that doesn't mean that on a given day, Fokina can't be the better player.
Right. No, I see that. And I liked how after the match, he just let out a big, yeah. Because I'm sure the whole time during the match, he just kept hearing Shelton, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then when he won, he just finally let it out.
Getting back at him.
All right. How about our other American?
Yeah. Tiafoe lost to Bublik in two sets. So I expected it. That's why he was my bet of the week last week.
Yeah.
But, like I was saying, when I was making that bet, he hasn't been super impressive since the US Open. Obviously, he made a pretty solid run there. But since then, he hasn't shown that level. And I think Tiafoe is very similar to Shelton based on what we've seen from Shelton so far, where they have flashes where they're incredible players, they're top 10 level players, but other times they don't play like they're even in the top 40. So while Shelton, I think we have a little bit more time to develop and see if he can become more consistent, it seems like Tiafoe is kind of almost settled into a little bit of a pattern where week to week, you don't know what to expect.
Right. And I do think that lost to Shelton in the US Open really messed with his confidence too. I just feel like right now he's kind of all over the place. And the fact that he lost to Shelton in that huge match just kind of made him really second guess how he's playing.
Yeah, kind of like that article you brought up about Tommy Paul being like, did Shelton pass me by and is my time gone? Maybe Tiafoe's feeling that even a little bit more because now there's maybe an even more exciting, even younger guy almost stepping into Tiafoe's sort of niche as a player.
Right.
And Tiafoe's thinking, is my time done? Is my time to be the best American player over? Is my time to make deep runs at a Grand Slam over? Is this guy going to take my spot almost? And that can mess with your head.
Yeah. No, another thing I'm kind of thinking about right now about this will be just specific to the loss to Bublik is they're kind of similar players as far as like engaging the crowd, trick shots. Maybe Bublik got into Tiafoe's head there and kind of dished him back what he usually dishes other players. And Tiafoe's probably just not used to it.
I mean, that can be a scary mental game to if you're both not the most consistent and you're both just going into it like, I just got to get into my opponent's head. That can probably lead to a pretty toxic atmosphere in the match.
I feel like it's so hard to play Bublik because you don't know if he's going to underhand serve or just rip a 130 mile an hour serve at you.
100%. 100%. But last match I wanted to bring up from that first round was Murray. Another choke against Deminar. Dude,
poor guy, man.
Yeah, that's exactly my feeling. Deminar is now 6-0 against Murray, and Murray had so many chances to win this match. He served 5-2 in the third and had another match point at 5-4. So as much as I really like Deminar, and he's one of my favorite players to watch, it is painful to watch these matches sometimes because I like Murray too. I like Murray as a player, but it just
feels... You know why, right?
Because he's a great player and I've been watching him for a long time.
Because you pity him.
No, I don't think that's the reason. But it does feel bad when you're watching a guy choke. So.
Mm-hmm. No, definitely. And did you see him just go to town on his racket after the match?
Yeah, I don't blame him either. That's just, you've just got to be so pissed at yourself, especially because when he was serving at 5-2 and when he lost that match point, they were both like, he just made a really bad mistake. Because we've talked about in the past, like Deminar makes you beat him. He doesn't just make an error himself. Mm-hmm. He's like, you have to beat me with a good shot. And they were kind of just rallying. And then Murray kind of mishit a couple balls. And he's just like, this is just so annoying. This guy won't go away.
Yeah. He's like a little gnat that just can't get.
Exactly.
But this brings up another point. Remember where I was talking about it last week? Do you think Deminar should have beat Andy Murray pretty handedly? Like, I think Deminar is significantly better than Andy Murray.
Maybe part of his strategy is wear down his opponent. Maybe part of his strategy is dependent on balancing out his energy, knowing when to go all out and when to pull back. And maybe he does that more than other guys so that he'll win more matches, but he'll have longer matches.
Okay. Well, what if he's not a great player? What if he's not as talented or, you know, skillful as the others, but like you said, he's able to wear people down. Does that make him a great player? Does a great player just get wins and that's it? Or is a great player also graceful and point construction and like all around skills?
It kind of reminds me of like the argument people have in golf where people are like, oh, is Tiger Woods the GOAT or is like Jack Nicklaus the GOAT? Where Nicklaus has more like major wins, but Tiger won by way more in those tournaments. Mm-hmm. So it kind of sounds like what you're talking about, where Deminar doesn't dominate people, but he does get the wins. So I think he is a great player, but I don't think he necessarily is as dominant of a player as you might see from some other top guys.
Mm-hmm.
All right, you want to move on to the next round though?
Yeah, this guy Safulin, he kind of pulls these out of nowhere with these upsets.
Dude, I mean... He's been having a sneaky good year because in the second half of 2023, like he was outside the top 100 in May of this year. So only like 6 months ago, he was outside the top 100. Now he's number 39 after this tournament. So that's a pretty significant rise in half a year.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it keeps going or do you think it's just the initial, you know, like the diminishing marginal increases in rankings?
Well, I think that's always going to happen. It's way harder to rise from number 39 to number like 20 than it is to rise from like 500 to number 200.
Right.
Just because that's how the points break down. The level difference is significantly higher. To me, it just brings up the question, like, is Alcaraz healthy? What's going to happen in Turin? You kind of have to make the assumption that there's something up because normally the number two guy in the world doesn't lose to a guy outside the top 40.
Yeah, especially in the round of 32.
Yeah, don't know really what happened. But yeah, I think Safulin's on a positive trend based on how he's been performing recently. Made the final in Chengdu, like we talked about. Beat Zverev, beat some good guys, and now has beaten Alcaraz. So
it's funny to see like little glimpses of Nadal in Alcaraz right now because you saw that with Nadal where he would – you know, lose sometimes first round or he would get tired out there on the court. I feel like Alcaraz, you could easily tell he's injured. He's not moving as well. And it just kind of reminds me of Nadal back in the like early 2000s when you'd see him win slams and then leave first round the next tournament.
I remember 2012, he came into Wimbledon as one of the top seeds and then lost to Lucas Rosol in like the first or second round, who was like number 128 in the world at the time. Stuff like that just happens sometimes. And we've had Alcaraz lose to guys like Safelin, guys like the Hungarian headhunter, Marozsán. You don't expect to see that at all. And so you wonder about how his consistency is going to be, because obviously he has the top level. We know he can play in those matches like Cincinnati against Djokovic, where he lost, but it was like the match of the year. He can beat Djokovic at Wimbledon, which is like Djokovic, arguably one of the best grass court players of all time. So it's tough to see. And I think we'll see going into next year. I think it's not a bad spot to be in for Alcaraz, because he can win slams. And we just know that if he plays at his highest level, that's what he can achieve. And so he's always going to be a threat in massive tournaments.
Yeah. And it's a long season. So we're coming up to the end of it, and maybe it's just wear and tear.
100%. Speaking on wear and tear, Fritz withdrew in this round, and it's really just a bummer for him, because obviously he was number 9 in the ATP finals spots, or number 10, maybe going into this tournament. So he still had a chance to make it to the ATP finals and now has to pull out and ruin any chance that he had. So feels pretty bad for him.
I wonder what, if it was kind of like one of those things where it's been nagging him and he just made it worse and worse, or if it was just a one-time jerk injury that happened in the last match and he just couldn't play on.
Based on the timing of the season, you'd guess that it's a wear and tear.
Because remember Nadal had to pull out of Wimbledon a couple of years ago when he gave Kyrgios the free pass.
Oh, yeah. That was
an abdominal injury.
That was a crazy situation. Yeah. You get just to jump straight from the quarters to the final.
Fritz got shafted, I think, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, we've talked about this before, but like, you can't really have it be like Fritz gets to go through.
I know.
But it also
is prize money.
Yeah. Also just unfortunate for him. He's like, you couldn't have withdrawn in like the fifth set or whatever it was. Yeah.
So he's done for the year, basically. Is that what you're...
Pretty much. I mean, there's no real big tournaments than the ATP finals. And
so the next time we'll see him, Australian Open, likely.
Yeah.
All right, so he's got 2 months, get back on track. Let's touch back on Dimitrov and Medvedev, that match. Because Medvedev calls himself a hard court specialist, and then I expected at least a semi or some kind of run for Medvedev this tournament.
Yeah, I mean, Quinn called last week. Crazy call, actually.
Crazy call. Yeah. Crazy call.
He was like, I think he's going to beat him in the second round. I'm like, dude, he has to make it there
when
first.
When he said that, I was kind of like in my head, I don't know.
Yeah, and but
proved me wrong.
Especially, it was funny because Dimitrov was playing Musetti in the first round, and he won the first set, I think 6-2, and then he was up in the second set, I want to say, and Musetti like came back and won the second set, and Quinn texted me like, oh my god, if I make this call and then Dimitrov loses in the first round, but he pulled it off and then made it to that second round and somehow pulled it out of Medvedev in that super tight match, but really impressive. Honestly, I think Dimitrov has had a very sneaky good year, because he's just been very consistent, very solid, has some pretty solid wins. And then obviously this is a massive result for him, but started the year at number 28 in the world, but now he's number 14. So that's a step up. Every time you cut your ranking in half, that's a significant step up. So,
oh, definitely. I just think he needs to do a better job of point construction. Like, you know how people kind of compare him to Federer?
Yeah.
Just because he has that one-handed backhand. He is not he's not nearly as patient as Federer is. And I think once he starts doing that, then we can even see him probably in the top 10.
Yeah, I think the thing about him is that I think if he plays aggressive and goes for his shots and tries to control the point, he can be a top 10 level player. But the issue is that he sometimes falls back into the pattern of relying on that slice backhand and relying on just being a really consistent player. And against a lot of these top level guys, that's not gonna pay off. And I think we kind of saw it in the final today. Like, if he just slices the ball and sits on that and tries to beat someone like Djokovic, with a slice and consistency, it's just not going to happen.
No, it's going to come right back.
Yeah. But one interesting thing I saw this week was UTR, which is Universal Tennis Rating, I want to say. They ranked Dimitrov inside the top 10 players in the world. And it makes sense based on his performance. Like, he's beaten a lot of good guys. He hasn't lost to a lot of guys that are, like, terrible. But it doesn't necessarily convert always to points.
Yeah. Well, remember when they dropped that top 10, we were texting about it. Kind of go over what goes into the UTR rankings.
So UTR ratings are like a rating of someone's ability rather than a ranking compared to other people.
They score you based off certain variables and then give you the rating. And obviously, it's not like ranking where you're being compared to other players based on your point performance in the past.
Exactly. Exactly.
Interesting. I wonder, so the UTR, who really looks at these ratings, these rankings? Are they pretty...
It's used a lot in college tennis recruiting. You can kind of get an idea of how good someone is just based on their UTR rating.
Got it. Yeah. So still relevant. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Let's talk about Tommy Paul now.
Yeah. Tommy Paul loses to Van de Zandschulp.
How about the match before too? 6-0.
I remember I checked the score and I was like, what happened in this first set that he lost 6-0?
But then in the third set too, we were talking like, oh, looks like he's got it under control. I think it was 5-3. I was like, yeah, he does. Cause I was watching it and then I left and then I checked the score and it went into a tiebreaker and I'm pretty sure he had to save match points.
Just what, you don't know what to expect from this guy.
Yeah.
It's funny because like based on his results, he hasn't been playing super poorly. But he just hasn't been playing excellent. And one thing that I noticed when I was like looking at his ATP overview, I didn't realize he only won one title in his career.
No.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was Stockholm, right?
Yeah, Stockholm in 2021. He's only won title.
He went to the Cabo final, I believe, against Demina, remember?
Yeah, well, he didn't win it.
Acapulco, yeah.
He didn't win it.
No, he didn't win it, I know.
And but,
wow.
Something that it makes me wonder, like, is it better to be consistently like a solid player like him?
Yeah.
Or to have those flashes of brilliance like someone like Shelton, where some tournaments he loses in the first round, other tournaments you're like, this guy could win the whole thing.
Honestly, I would probably say spurts like Shelton, just so you have a nice trophy case at your house.
and also, I think that's probably better for recognition as a player.
You think it's better for money?
That'd be an interesting thing to look into. Yeah. But like
at the end of the day, they just want to make a living.
Yeah. Well, not necessarily. Maybe? I think legacy is important to players. Being considered a great player is part of it. Making a living is obviously a part of it because they're doing it. They're getting paid to do it. But I don't think that's necessarily the only.
How about
reason.
This? How about listen to this? So my take is players who are playing to make a living, they know they're not going to win anything big, right? If you're playing tennis to just make a living, you're playing exactly what I just said, to make a living. You're not playing to win titles. If you're ranked in the top 30, I would say you're playing to win titles. That's what's giving you like the push and the motivation to go out and play. Not so much, all right, let me play so I can get this check and pay my mortgage. That's what players who are ranked in the top 100, 200 are doing.
Yeah, I think it's tough to say because I think everybody's mentality going out there is like you're playing to win. You're never playing to like make the third round. But if you do make the third round and lose at like a grand slam, you'd be like, okay, I got a pretty nice check for that. Yeah,
because you're not expected to win.
Yeah, it's...
And you know it deep in your heart.
It's tough to talk about like the motivation for these players, though.
Yeah, exactly. It is because
we're not the players. So, yeah.
All right. How about round of 16? Zverev Tsitsipas. This is one of them. I call it a rivalry because I feel like they're both like it's a next gen rivalry. They both kind of came up together. Tsitsipas has the upper hand in the head to head 9-4, which I thought it would be closer. Wouldn't you?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, especially because Zverev kind of came up a little bit earlier than Tsitsipas. Mm-hmm. So you would expect it like early on Zverev had the advantage and then it kind of balanced out. But it seems like Tsitsipas got on top of him pretty quickly in terms of the head-to-head.
Yeah, and I just think that's because Zverev had that setback a couple years ago, broke his ankle. I think now it'll start evening out because Zverev is getting back into top form, which I'm really excited to see. And a reason I also say it's a rivalry, like kind of when they came up together, they both looked pretty similar. They had that long, they're both tall, kind of look alike in the face. Don't you agree? Like, if you're a tennis novice and you're watching both of them play, not against each other, but separately, you're like, oh, I thought I just saw him play. Like, granted, the styles are different.
I mean, yeah, obviously. if you're a novice, like, you could maybe just see, like, a couple guys with longer hair that are, like, players. I don't know.
I guess that's mostly where I'm coming from, yeah.
It's hard to see from, like, someone else's eyes, you know what I mean? So, yeah. Maybe, yeah.
I think another thing that makes it a rivalry is there's just the drama around it. Like, it's not necessarily the outcome of the match, but I feel like Zverev is always complaining about Tsitsipas's dad or his box, and then Tsitsipas is complaining about Zverev taking a bathroom break. Like, it's a lot of that stuff that goes into it. So, you know, when these two play each other, they're not the best of friends. It's going to be a little chippy, maybe some vocal back and forth with them.
Yeah. How much do you think, like, off court, like, media attention impacts a rivalry like that? Because, like, the biggest rivalry in history, Federer versus Nadal, was such a big one, not just, I think, because of the on-court stuff, but also because the media was able to take that and build it into, like, an even bigger story about these two people. So how much do you think that actually impacts it? Because
I think it's a little different. I don't think this is apples to apples, because it wasn't so much them complaining about their antics. It's more so the media doing it themselves versus, like, Zverev yelling at Tsitsipas' dad. Like, Federer never yelled at Uncle Tony, you know what I mean?
In this situation, it's like the players are creating the narrative rather than the media creating.
Exactly, yeah. Because they're just not good enough for the media to create the rivalry.
Yeah, I mean, the media can create the rivalry right now of, like, Djokovic versus Alcaraz, because that's like the best matchup right now that we have in tennis. But,
and there's great stories. It's someone who's at the tail end of their career and someone who's just starting up. So you kind of get that contrast too.
Yeah, I think contrast is a great part of a rivalry, because that's a classic trope. It's like when you have two gladiators in the pit, and one's like the big strong one and the other one's the small fast one. It's like, you always want to see the contrast and see what happens and who comes out on top.
Yeah, exactly. Well, there is kind of another rivalry brewing here. Runa Djokovic. Maybe not so much a rivalry, but a lot of story around it.
I think you were about to talk about Boris Becker, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. I mean, Djokovic said it's going to be weird if he had to play Runa and see Boris, because he considered Boris a dear friend. They obviously worked together for a while, and I don't know what that would be like. It would, because I don't know their relationship. So playing against someone, because when you're that old, it's not like a coach player dynamic, right? They're kind of on more of an even level.
I think it's still a little bit of a coach player dynamic, but also it's like you look at those two guys, and there's got to be a level where Djokovic is thinking, what is this guy telling him about my game? Because it's not like you probably sign like an NDA. Like, I doubt Boris Becker signs an NDA with Djokovic. Like, I'm not going to tell – if I sign another player to coach, I'm not going to tell them about, oh, you have this thing. Oh, you have this thing. So you're looking across the other box. Like, this guy knows the secrets of my game, and he can give them all to this my opponent.
Yeah. Well, how about this? So obviously there's pressure with Djokovic and Runa. Do you think Boris also felt that? Like, this was a big match for him? Or do you think he kind of – was a little more at ease than Runa or Djokovic? Like, do you think all three of them felt the same amount of pressure in this match?
Well, I don't think Becker felt the same amount of pressure, because he's not playing in it.
That's what I was asking. But I don't know if it was like a personal thing between him and Djokovic, where he wanted this match just as bad as Runa did.
In tennis, it's such an individual thing. Like, it's you can't want it as much as the player does, because they're the one person out there.
I think you can. I just think it doesn't work out.
Yeah.
Like, you can have a coach pushing a player. Like, I bet Tsitsipas' dad wants it more than he does.
Maybe. I mean, that's tough to say. Tsitsipas probably is pretty driven. I think that maybe that narrative comes through because his dad is clearly very passionate about his son's success.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know whether that translates to him necessarily wanting it more than Tsitsipas does.
Yeah, that just makes me think of that father that's trying to live vicariously through his son. Like, oh, it would have been me if I never got injured, so I'm gonna push my son. And then when you see your son's success, you kind of relive that.
But that can lead to, like, burnout from the kid.
Oh my god, tell me about it. I had a buddy, a good friend, his dad played professional baseball in the minors, and he had two older brothers, like all three of them just got burnt out one at a time, because the dad pushed them so hard. He wanted all of them to go to college, play baseball in college, and then eventually go on to the MLB.
Yeah.
I've seen it.
It's very interesting because there's a tough level there where if you want your kid to be really successful at the sport, you have to push them, but you also have to like nurture their love of the game.
Mm-hmm.
If you push them too hard, they're just going to burn out and be like, I hate this sport. I don't want to do it.
Yeah.
But if you can nurture the love of the game and push them, then they're going to be a great player.
Heck yeah. All right. So the finals are set.
Before we jump into that, I just want to talk about Sinner in the round of 16 pulled out, because the way that the tournament got scheduled, he played a match, ended at like 2 a.m. Mm-hmm. And then his next match was scheduled for like 2 p.m. that day. So he had like 12 hours between the end of his first match and the start of his next one.
Was that the match against McDonald that ended at 2 a.m.?
I think so.
Yeah, no, that's tough. And the players speak out about it all the time, but I just don't think there will ever be any resolution to this. I know it's not fair, especially if your opponent has more rest than you. But what I was wondering is, early on in the tournament, you know how you usually get a day off? It's like you play, day off, then you play. And then towards the end, then you start playing every day. So if they were to make the tournaments, because they always end on a Sunday, they always start on Monday, at least the first round. Yeah. Qualifiers start a little earlier. But if you were to just automatically give every player a day off and extend the tournament to maybe a week and a half, 2 weeks, not necessarily end it on a Sunday, that's the only resolution I see to this, which is not really possible because the tournaments are set a year in advance.
Yeah, it's also like, oh, I have a tournament on this week, and then the next tournament starts on Monday of the next week.
Yeah. Well, then you pull out of it.
Yeah, which maybe they'd be more well-rested. Yeah, but it would be a massive, I think, negative for the ATP. I don't think they would ever do that. People would be like, why would I go to Tokyo? Because all the good players are still going to be playing in Shanghai.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. That's the only possible scenario that I see with scheduling.
Yeah, it's tough. It's definitely tough. I don't know if there's any real solution to it. It just was a tough situation to see for a top player.
But that McDonald match was crazy because Sinner's clearly the better player. And I think McDonald made Sinner play so many extra points where you would thought Sinner would have had a winner. And then McDonald just went for the, like, oh, the slice, or got the ball back somehow and forced Sinner to make an error where he would either hit it in the net or hit it wide. I saw how resilient and persistent McDonald was, which credit to him. I think he played Sinner very well.
Yeah. I don't remember if it was Alafia or who it was, but someone was talking about how just all those guys that went to UCLA are just incredible baseline players. And I think that's what we saw with McDonald in this match, like just playing great baseline tennis and just getting all those balls back.
Mm-hmm, for sure. All right, now can we get to the ATP finals?
Yeah, I mean, I thought it was kind of funny because at the quarterfinals, we still technically had like a couple guys that could make it and knock out like Runa from that last spot. Hurkacz and Deminar, obviously I'm saying Deminar, he had to win the tournament for him to make it through, but he still technically was in it. But obviously Hurkacz lost to Dimitrov, who was playing great the whole tournament. And Deminar lost to Rublev after doing kind of what he did to Medvedev in the US Open, where stole the first set, but then Rublev upped his game and it wasn't really that close.
So at this point in the tournament, were you just as interested or not as much because the finals were already set? I feel like it would have made it more interesting if...
I think the fact that someone like Dimitrov was still in it made it interesting because he's obviously a guy you didn't expect to be in the semifinals. So I was pretty interested. I was more interested, I would say, in Dimitrov against Tsitsipas than I was in Rublev versus Djokovic. Obviously, it's enjoyable to watch still, because it's a high level of tennis, but you kind of expect Djokovic to win. Versus Dimitrov versus Tsitsipas, you're like, Tsitsipas is maybe higher ranked, but Dimitrov seems to be a little bit more informed, so we'll see what happens.
Mm-hmm. That Rublev-Djokovic match, I feel like that's the ideal matchup for Djokovic. Someone like Rublev, where they are so aggressive and go for all these hard shots, where Djokovic is like, yep, I'm just going to be a wall, and I'm going to let you make the mistake, make the error.
Yeah.
Or force the error, I should say.
Yeah. And it probably just pisses Rublev off so much because he's just hitting the crap out of the ball. And then Djokovic is like, nope, I'm just going to hit that one back.
Absorbing
to you.
Pace. Yeah.
Exactly.
And then he smash his racket at the end of the match.
Yeah. He played really well.
He did.
But just not
he did.
Good enough to beat Djokovic, which is like a different level you have to play at.
Dude, Djokovic is so funny because I'll get into it a little later with him consoling Dimitrov. But at the end, after the Rublev match, he gassed him up. He said, wow, this is probably the best I've ever seen Rublev. He was in amazing shape. He was like strangling me, but I won. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's kind of like you're complimenting the other player.
Yeah. I don't know if I've talked about this in the past, but I remember I saw an interview with, I don't remember who it was. Maybe it was like Michael Chandler. But he was talking about when UFC guys go up and console someone after they just knock them out. And he's like, it's the most disrespectful thing that person can do. Because while to the crowd, it seems like, oh, this guy's such a good dude for consoling him. It's also like, yeah, you're just not on my level, bro. But good try.
Yeah basically.
Hopefully it's a little bit more genuine from Djokovic, but yeah. I don't know.
I just see, to me, that matchup was like a little brother just trying to fight the big brother, and the big brother's just pushing him away. And the little brother's getting so frustrated the whole time. Like,
yeah.
Where the big brother just doesn't really care. That's where I see Rublev right now. Just that, like, he's good, he's scrappy, but he's just not going to get
He's an incredible player. He's top five in the world, but he's playing the best guy in the world. So it's just a tough spot to be in. But the other semifinal, Dimitrov versus Tsitsipas, close match, but Dimitrov got it done. I was really impressed by him this whole tournament. To be honest, I think as a tennis fan, Tsitsipas, while he was probably disappointed, for me, I was like, honestly, a good result for him because it still shows that he can make these big runs like he made last year, earlier in the year in his career, and hasn't been making as many recently, but shows he still has that ability.
I agree. I definitely agree. And we talked about this before, stacking those little wins, you know, just incrementally increasing your runs in each tournament will ultimately lead to better results. And I can't believe we've gone an episode so far without mentioning FAA.
Oh my gosh.
I just thought about it. Like,
yeah. Well, I mean, he lost to Tsitsipas 40 minutes in the second round.
Yeah. But no, it kind of reminded me, okay, Tsitsipas, he was kind of variable. I didn't know whether or not he was going to make a run. He did, made it to the semis, and maybe the finals, he'll do something.
Yeah, that'd be cool to see. I mean, obviously he's won the finals in the past, and
2019.
Yeah.
That's a while ago too.
So we'll see what happens. We got a few former winners in there. Zverev has won it, obviously. Djokovic has won it. Tsitsipas has won it.
Medvedev's
won it. So
yeah,
we'll see what happens here. Anything can happen in the finals.
Yeah, I know. All right, let's get into this final then.
Yeah, when Djokovic beats Dimitrov 6-4, 6-3. What did you think of the match just initially?
At first, I thought that I made a bet. I took the over on sets 2.5 because I thought that with Djokovic usually starting out slower, that Dimitrov was going to kind of pounce in, take the first set, but then Djokovic would always come back, make his adjustments, win the next two. So once Djokovic got that break in the first set, I knew it was over at that point, the match, because Djokovic very rarely goes down after. I think he's usually better at starting slow and then finishing hot. I also thought Dimitrov's nerves were visible. Like, he was slicing the ball. He couldn't really make loose shots. He was kind of just, like you said earlier, keeping the ball in play, playing very conservatively, and then towards the end started opening up, loosening up, and he was making a lot of errors, but then again, he was hitting a lot of winners. So not the best final. Just those are my initial thoughts, and then we can talk about after too.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like Dimitrov got kind of lucky. I was going to talk about this a little later, but yeah, the matchup in this spot, it seems like Dimitrov, after he won against Medvedev, the draw kind of just opened up for him. He then played Bublik, then Hurkacz, then Tsitsipas, who are guys that, while they're good players, are all beatable guys. Mm-hmm. And what's funny to me is, like, it kind of sets up a situation where that match where Dimitrov played Medvedev ended up being probably the most important match of the bottom half. That set up this final where Djokovic plays Dimitrov and Djokovic beats him pretty handedly, even though Djokovic had to battle through tougher guys in earlier rounds. Like, he had to play Runa and had an intense three-setter, plays Rublev, has an intense three-setter, and then the final actually ends up being an easier match for him.
So you think Djokovic coming into this final is like, all right, sweet. I got an easy match today.
I don't think he necessarily was like, is an easy match because he saw Dimitrov easier playing very well. Ones. But I think, yeah, easier probably.
And having beat this guy 11 times before.
Yeah, yeah. I think he probably was like a little bit more comfortable going into this match than he was against Runa or Rublev, because those guys are top five guys, top six guys, guys going to the ATP finals.
Yeah.
Versus Dimitrov is a guy that, while he's playing really well right now, hasn't shown that top level that much recently.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about his emotion too. So we saw it after his Tsitsipas match, and then we saw it again today after this final. So it's been 6 years since he's won a Masters 1000, and you could just tell after, like, he completely broke down. He lost it, crying, towel over the head. Do you think that's because he knows in his heart that he's not going to be back there? Like, why so much emotion?
That's definitely part of it. I think when you don't do it for 6 years and then you make a run all the way to the final and then lose, it's just got to be so depressing, because his goal was to obviously win the tournament coming into it, but he couldn't have expected to be in the final going into this tournament. And someone like Djokovic does expect to be in the final because he's just that level of player. And so Dimitrov gets to the final and he's like, okay, this is like my one chance, and then doesn't get it done. I mean, I was just watching this documentary about Neymar on Netflix. Paris Saint-Germain makes the Champions League final, and it's like, they've never done that before. This is so crazy. Oh my God. And then they lose, and you're like, the emotion there is so much more intense because it wasn't expected for them to be there.
Mm-hmm, I agree. And I think whenever this happens, like this odd anomaly happens, you kind of expect it to finish out, to play out. Like, oh, wow, Dimitrov makes this crazy run, hasn't been in a Masters final in 6 years. I think he's got to do it, right? Like, this is how the story ends. And then when it doesn't, that's when people are upset. Like, oh, PSG never made it to the finals. Like, they have to win. This is what it's going to be. And then they don't.
Yeah, but it's just how it goes with, like, when you're playing as Djokovic, you just don't get the there's no quarter given from Djokovic. Mm-hmm.
Oh, man. And do you think when Dimitrov was crying and Djokovic was in the middle of his speech, but then he kind of cut it, went over to console him, like gave him a few words of encouragement, hugged him, and then went back, that was a classy move, or more so like patronizing to him?
I think there's a level in tennis where he's known this guy for 10 years. So they're maybe not the closest friends ever, but they're friends. Mm-hmm. So I think it's definitely not a patronizing move, in my opinion.
So I agree with you on that. But then there's also that little part of me that's a little suspicious of Djokovic, who I don't know how authentic he really is, and if he's just doing it as like a popularity boost. Because you know how he was booed a lot this tournament?
Yeah.
Parisian crowd just kind of went to town on him. And I don't know, maybe if that's just a PR stunt, he's like, oh yeah, let me get good publicity. And then you also saw the fans, the Parisian fans were chanting Grigor, Grigor. Like, they were behind him. They felt bad for him. They wanted him to win.
I think Djokovic is really good at hiding his emotions, but I think that doesn't mean he doesn't have emotions. And so I think he feels sympathetic for Dimitrov. And then in other situations, when the crowd's getting mad at him, he feels angry. He gets pissed at them. He's like, why are you guys rooting against me? And so that's why he acts out against them. So I don't think it's a situation where he's always this villain and he's always thinking, oh, I'm just going to try to boost my PR, even though I'm like not really a good person. In this situation, he was being a really kind and sympathetic person. In other situations, he's being like an angry and aggressive person when he's taunting the crowd.
Yeah, I do think Djokovic is a genuinely good guy, nice guy. I just had to pose the question.
But yeah, overall, not really surprised Djokovic ended up winning it. He's going to be the year-end number one. Like, that's just how it's going to end out. He's 1,500 points ahead of Alcaraz now. So while technically it's not wrapped up, it pretty much is. The only way for Alcaraz to steal the year-end number one is to win the ATP finals, but not only win, be undefeated, and Djokovic has to lose every single match.
Yeah, so very unlikely.
Yeah, very unlikely that Djokovic doesn't end up the year number one, but I guess still possible.
Yeah, insane though too, because he won three Grand Slams and just kind of took off the rest.
Yeah.
Like, really didn't play too much tennis after the US Open.
Yeah, but I mean, it's also like he didn't get to play in the Sunshine Double, right? So
yeah.
Jeez. Still has those COVID restrictions.
Yeah.
But
all right.
Yeah, you ready to hop into segments?
Yeah, let's do it. What is new in tennis? So I saw Djokovic got a new agent, and he's trying to reshape his media presence. He is kind of setting himself up for life after tennis, because it's kind of weird to think about it. But yeah, his career is not going to last forever, maybe 2 or 3 more years. And what better time to do this than right now, where you're kind of on top, you know, you're number one. You have great commercial potential right now. So he parted ways with his current agent, Artaldi, and he's with this new guy, Mark Madden. Dude, there's nothing on the internet about this guy. It is pretty funny, but hey, Djokovic trusts him, I guess. So hopefully this guy will try to help rebuild his image after kind of years of being that villain, like you said.
I don't know why it's necessarily always like critical that guys build up this image after, because like Djokovic doesn't need the money, really. Like, he has so much.
I think it's his mentality. I think he's wanting to win so much on the tennis court, and when you take that away from him, he's not just going to turn it off. And I think he needs to win at other aspects in life. I think Tom Brady's kind of going through a little bit of a struggle right now, where he's been playing football for the last 2 decades and winning, and right now without football, I think he was rumored to be dating one of the Kardashians. He's going out a lot more. He's like getting drunk. He's being a scene in the public, whereas he could easily just retire to a cabin in Montana and live out life low key, like on a ranch, simple. Yeah. But he doesn't want to do that.
Yeah, you have guys like Brady, but like you have other guys like Andrew Luck, who went to the NFL, played 10 seasons, retired, and just disappeared off the face of the earth.
But you can't compare Andrew Luck's success to Djokovic's.
Yeah. I have a question for you, actually. Do you think that Djokovic is going to retire first, or LeBron's going to retire first?
Dude, that's a great question. Isn't LeBron waiting for his son?
Yeah, is Bronny going to go one and done? I don't know. We probably shouldn't bring this up, but
I know, right?
It's basketball, not tennis. But
it is funny, though, seeing, because Djokovic is trying to, like I said, build up his media presence. So he's playing in the Ryder Cup tournament. He's going to the rugby match. Was it the World Championship? Rugby,
yeah, match? He went to the Ballon d'Or presentation.
Yeah, right? See what I mean? Like, he's trying to put himself out there more.
Yeah.
So I think he's all for it.
Yeah.
All right, what about you? What did you see this week in tennis?
I saw one thing that was pretty cool was Alex Mickelson is kind of poised to qualify for the next-gen finals in Jeddah. I don't know necessarily when the cutoff is for those, but he's number 10 right now. And with Rune and Alcaraz going to the ATP finals, as the number 10, he's the 8th guy outside those two. So pretty crazy that he'll qualify after turning pro this year.
Yeah.
That's pretty insane to me. Qualifying for the next gen finals is a pretty impressive accomplishment.
Yeah. All right. Let's get into bet of the week now.
All righty. My bet of the week is Bautista Agut +120 over Popperin in Sofia. Bautista Agut was out from July to October, and he hasn't had the best return, but I still think he has what it takes to beat Popperin, especially because Popperin has lost in the first round in 5 out of his last 6 tournaments. So I think Bautista can come out. He's obviously a veteran on the tour, and I think he can get it done.
Yeah, no, I like that. I like that bet. I cannot root for Bautista Agut. I don't like him.
Why don't you
I don't like his face.
Oh, God. That's just so mean.
It's so mean. I know. I just can't. I hate him.
Yeah. You're like, I don't like his face, so I just can't. Yeah,
it's terrible.
Yeah.
Yeah, not a lot of action this week. So I am doing Kecmanovic -180 over Rodionov. Like I said, not a lot of action. So I'm looking in these like smaller tournaments, and it's early on. So I'm just going based off name recognition here. I think -180 isn't terrible odds for someone like Kecmanovic against Rodionov. I mean, do you know this guy?
I think I've heard the name, but I don't really know that much about him.
Yeah, so not a whole lot.
Kecmanovic just beat Rune like a couple weeks ago. So he's obviously
exactly
a pretty solid level.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, you want to hop into match of the week?
Yeah, let's do it. Mine was the Deminar Murray match. So tight first set. Murray came back in the second, pretty much looked like he was dominating the third, was up 5-2, had a match point, and Deminar goes on to win 5 games in a row. So we pretty much covered this earlier on. I just love the fact that Deminar showed scrappiness.
It ain't over till it's over.
Exactly. I just can't. I feel so bad for Murray after, like, because he's already a grumpy guy to begin with, even when he's winning. And then to lose that, one smash, but like repeated smashes of the racket. That thing was toast.
100%. Yeah. Tough.
All right, what about you?
My match was Djokovic beating Runa 7-6, 6-7, 6-4. Super tight match all throughout. Just a high level of tennis. I think wasn't necessarily like always the flashiest. It was just like they were playing such a high level of point construction on both sides. And I mean, to me, it's a little bit like the Becker aspect shown through, because it's almost like a chess match between those two guys in this match. So Runa didn't really seem to give an inch, but Djokovic just outplayed him a little bit.
Yeah. Hopefully we see that rematch pretty soon here.
Yeah, it could be cool to see that in the ATP Finals.
I know. All right, and that's the show. If you're not already subscribed, go ahead and hit that subscribe button. You can find us on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube at Painting Lines Podcast. Feel free to shoot us a DM or email us any questions or thoughts at paintinglinespodcast@gmail.com.